Well, it's time for a show. Good morning and welcome. And we are very happy that you are with us on this Tuesday morning. It is January the 6th, and we know what that date means now. And it's the fifth anniversary of what happened at the Capitol of the United States on January 6, 2021. We will talk about that this morning, plus what else is happening, of course, in Venezuela and elsewhere. We have a great panel assembled this morning to talk about these issues and others. And we welcome you, of course, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. .org. Here's a funny little thing. A month from now, we're gonna be doing a fun drive again. And so the fun drive will start on February, I believe it's February 2nd, the fun drive will begin. And we are getting ready for that. And we get ready for that. We're going to start a fun drive on Groundhog Day. How cool is that? Punxsutawney Phil will come out and say, I think you're going to make it.
It's sort of appropriate.
Yeah,
right?
That's right.
You've done it before.
And if not, you get six more weeks of fun drive.
So, well done.
Do it now. So that starts on February 2nd. So now, as you know, as we have, I think, taught you all that month out, we start the process of the lockbox, and the lockbox is open and welcome for you to help. Now, the lockbox is a device, if you will, of putting money in now so it's less we have to make later. And if you were with us for our last fund drive, the fund drive that took place in the fall of 2025, you will recall that that was a gloriously short fund drive. And the reason it was gloriously short is because you were also generous, number one. But number two, we had a lot of money going in on the lockbox. And that certainly seems to be the way we're headed this time. And we're hoping that we can continue that so that we can give you the programming. Stuff is happening all over the world. You know that. And we want to be on the air talking about that stuff more than we want to be talking about the fact that we need your money. But because you know that. You know that. Deep in your heart, you know that. So whatever you can do now is less that we have to do later. WAMC.org, WAMC.org. We'll be talking about it on and off for about 2 weeks and, just mentioning it. And then in about 2 weeks, we'll get a little more serious and break in a little bit more during this program and have you call in. But whatever we do now is less we have to do later, and we hope that you will join us. We have some exciting things planned for this fun drive, so stay tuned. But I think if we can make it really short and get back to what it is that we do and to have the discussions, these important discussions that we have on the roundtable and throughout the other programs on your WAMC radio dial. WAMC.org, 1-800-323-9262. We love you. We thank you for everything that you've always done for us, and we thank you for what you will do during this first fund drive of 2026. Oh, and don't forget, they took our money away. There's that. So still, we haven't gotten it back. So that's still an issue.
I saw a post last night from Congresswoman Claudia Tenney celebrating the demise of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and PBS. And I just thought, how sad for her. You know, having worked for a member of Congress, I thought, the things we celebrated as achievements. How sad that you think one of your achievements is
killing it.
The demise of PBS and, education program for kids and great cultural programming and news from around your community and around the world. That just seemed to me not an achievement to be celebrated, but apparently she's proud of it. So,
and the antidote to that is for our listeners who are proud of this radio station, who have been the family of this radio station and have been the backbone of this radio station, who also have a great commitment to it and show us their love each and every fun drive and all the time in between. And we know they'll be there in the future, and we thank them very, very much. And it's, as you well know, Teresa is often a volunteer, comes in and takes phone calls from people, and you hear from these people what the station means to them. So.
Yeah, I highly recommend it. It's great volunteering, listening to folks and why they like the station and such. And they're very patient with me taking down all that data.
Well, I know there's a lot of data that has, but that's all right.
A lot of data.
We want to know about you. All right. Well, let's get started here, and let me introduce everybody. I want to hear Terry Gibson's voice. We haven't heard that yet. Preceptor in Public Speaking, Strategic Communications, and Public Relations for the Faculty of Arts and Sciences at Harvard University. Good morning, Terry. Happy New Year to you.
Good morning. This is my voice. Happy New Year to you.
It's really great to have you here. I appreciate you being here as always. It's a real thrill to have you on the program and have another go around and have you on for another year. So thank you very much, as always. Robert Pendicio joins us, senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. Good morning, Robert.
Good morning, Joe, and nice to see you again. Last time I was here, you were on a well-deserved vacation.
Yeah, I had a nice vacation, and I'm back. I missed you all, but it's nice to be back. It was nice to take some time off, and it's... felt good. Yeah, it feels good. But I like being back. I don't know. You know, as lovely as Hawaii, this is absolutely true. You can believe me on this or not. But I swear to you it's true. But we're in Hawaii, and that's paradise. For anyone who's ever been there, it's just paradise. It's gorgeous. It's absolutely beautiful, breathtakingly beautiful. I was flying in to the Albany airport, and I looked down, and I just saw the snow and the mountains, and I thought to myself, all right, that's as beautiful.
I'm home. Yeah.
Oh, it is.
Like that, yeah.
It is
oh,
beautiful.
And, oh, my God. It's just stunning. And I thought, okay, this is home. This is where I love being. So
I'll tell you what, though. I like taking a trip away from here in late winter. I say this all the time. I love all four seasons. Couldn't live in Hawaii or Arizona, one of those places where there's no four seasons. But winter is the only one you get sick of. Nobody ever said, man, I wish summer would be over.
Yeah, that's true.
But by late February, you're ready for a week or so of 80 degrees.
That February and March and that just sort of slushy period.
Yeah, so but, good vacation, but you might have wanted to wait a little
while. Yeah, that's all right. No, I'll get out again. No, you
okay.
Worry. Teresa Bourgeois is here and is a public policy and communications expert a long time. Had been on the Hill in Washington, I would say a Washington insider.
Ooh.
Yes, worked in the House and Senate.
House and Senate, indeed, I did.
And so, with us this morning, on this day, to talk about all kinds of things, including the anniversary of January 6th. Good morning, Teresa. Happy New Year to you.
Good morning. Happy New Year. And I usually try to have a this day in history factoid or something like that. But today I want to have not past history, but I think it's important to note that there are 68,000 people that are in detention being held by our ICE. And it's the highest number. And most of them without due process, only 7% of them considered to have been convicted of violent crimes, more than 60% of them convicted of nothing. And those who were convicted of other things, it's mostly traffic offenses. And the reason I mention it, I heard a group of people... Japanese Americans who had been part of the detention centers, and one of them said, people say to me, I always wonder at that time when you were, when the Japanese detention happened, what would I have done if I were there and involved? And she said, now you have an answer for yourself based on what you're doing now. So anyway, I just mentioned that. 68,000 people.
Where did you get the number?
It was an assessment by a think tank based on ICE and CPB data.
All right. Well, it's sobering, isn't it?
It is 68,000 people. More than, actually. It's the highest number so far.
So we have a lot to talk about this morning, and we will do exactly that. We welcome you, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. And we thank you so much for being with us and for being a part of the discussion this morning. We are going to start off by talking about Venezuela and what is happening in Venezuela. And, this was our the big story over the weekend, the big story yesterday on our program. And we now have several—I mentioned this yesterday, but there's all kinds of there's many facets to the story, obviously, and we can't really talk about them all, but we're going to try to focus in on a couple of them and talk about different things. First of all, there is what President Maduro was taken and then was brought into court yesterday, pleaded not guilty, and then said that he had been kidnapped. There is now a great deal of debate as to what is next, and that is a question that remains. What is next in Venezuela, and something that is a big question. Members of the of Congress, the eight, what is it called?
The Gang of Eight.
The Gang of Eight.
Or they could have done the brief, the Gang of Four, but they didn't either. But the Gang of Eight.
The Gang of Eight. So they had they have a meeting yesterday, and then on top of that, the UN comes out and says what you have done is horrible. So there's all of that, and then there are the growth opportunities of what could happen to Cuba or Colombia or Greenland, which the president continues to talk about quite a bit over the last 24 to 36 hours. So the president and Secretary of State Marco Rubio have made clear that the collapse of Cuba's communist government is not only a likely side benefit of Maduro's ouster, but a goal. This is from the Washington Post now. Within hours of the operation, long before the government in Havana acknowledged it, phone calls and texts across the island spread the news that dozens of elite Cuban security forces had been killed guarding Maduro. No place was hit harder than Cuba by the shockwaves that Saturday morning's U.S. military seizure of Venezuela's Nicolas Maduro sent throughout Latin America and the world. But by the time it finally released a statement late Sunday saying that 32 of its military and security personnel were dead in Caracas, the Cuban government had bigger problems on its hands. Both President Donald Trump and Secretary of State Marco Rubio made clear over the weekend that the collapse of Cuba's communist government was not only a likely side benefit of Maduro's ouster, but a goal. Then we look at where we are in Greenland. Stephen Miller, yesterday speaking, asserts that U.S. has the right to take Greenland. The remarks were part of a push to justify American imperialism and a vision in which the U.S. could overthrow governments if it was in the national interest. This then has the Danish prime minister saying that the U.S. attack to seize Greenland would end NATO. And then the hits just keep on coming, because that is basically what... What got us here was what happened, of course, in Venezuela, and Venezuela bracing for economic collapse from a U.S. blockade. Venezuela could lose the bulk of its oil export revenues this year if the U.S. blockade stays in place, a scenario that would set off a humanitarian crisis, and that from the New York Times. So, man, a lot going on. We'll do our best to address as much as we possibly can about this U.S. operation in Venezuela and the many ripple effects. Terry Gibson, I will begin with you.
Well, it is a lot. When I think through all of this, I tend to focus on the things that I know, which is language. And I spend most of my time these days really examining language and how it's used to communicate. And when I listen to our current president and all the members of his administration speak about this issue regarding Venezuela, Cuba, Greenland, I can't help but think that they sound like a bunch of pirates. They just sound like a bunch of pirates that have no regard for laws, institutions, history, alliances. They are simply interested in obtaining the treasure. That's what they want. They are constantly talking about oil, the natural resources. They do not spend much time talking about the people that live in these countries. They don't spend much time talking about what the future looks like for these people. They mostly talk about how the U.S. or how they personally could possibly benefit from the treasure that these resources offer. And the language they use is straight out of sort of pirate language 101. It's to me unbelievable that the American people are willing to accept this. We are so close to having a president that is literally using the U.S. military for a pirating operation, and that means that he has been left unchecked without any guardrails. The only real guardrails that are really left to control him as administration are Congress, which still seems to just not be willing to put the guardrails up, and of course the American people, right, which are still not putting enough pressure where it needs to be to change the dynamic. There'll have to be a significant shift in public opinion, even more than there has been already, and I'm hoping that will happen. And there's going to have to be some brave Republicans that stand up and begin to push back. Otherwise, we are going to find ourselves in a Western Hemisphere mess where we're now running or trying to run three or four other countries. And we can't even seem to manage our own country. And that, I think, has to be pointed out, too, that all of this, whatever these pirates are doing, it's not doing anything to improve the quality of life for the American citizens right now. The cost of living isn't going down. The cost of food isn't going down. The cost of housing isn't going down. Health care is a major issue. These things go on. And it's clear this administration just does not care about domestic issues. So that's my take in 3 minutes.
Robert.
Oh, what a Gordian knot. Well, the Cold War is back, right? In other words, it feels like power politics is what's driving the train here. Look, Joe, let me start by saying something that I think is kind of assumed here on the round table. But let's just say it overtly today. None of us are experts on this, right? We are people who work in academics, in public policy, et cetera. You know, none of us are experts on foreign affairs and whatnot. You know, my main qualification for this discussion, the way I'm thinking about this discussion, is I'm reminded of when I was teaching a high school civic seminar, and I tried to make it about issues in the news, and I would prepare my students for, you know, for a meaty discussion on the policy ramifications of a given issue. Where we have tended to view this particular set of circumstances through the prism of the politics of the moment. So therefore, let me kind of, if you'll indulge me for a minute, you know, what's the history of these kinds of actions? You know, is how I would have framed it in speaking to students. So, look, there are four recurring justifications throughout, you know, U.S. history, and certainly in the last 50 years, that we've used for these kinds of, you know, military adventures. One, direct threats to U.S. security. Two, a humanitarian catastrophe or mass suffering. Three, defense of democratic legitimacy. Four, regional instability or spillover effects. And I suppose if I can invoke Terry's, I'll now add a fifth. You know, it's in our perceived economic interest. OK, so that's five. So in thinking about how to think about this, that's the prism that I've been using. So if you object to this because it's regime change or removal, well, then you also need to object or have objected to what we did in Panama in 1989 with Noriega. If you object to the goal of restoring democracy, well, then that takes Haiti off the table. That takes Grenada, 1983, off the table. If you say, well, humanitarian suffering is not a sufficient cause, well, there goes Kosovo, the Balkans, you know, under Clinton. There goes Libya. Under Barack Obama. If you object because Congress didn't authorize it, well then, man, there's a whole bunch of them you got to object to. Kosovo, Libya, Grenada, Panama, Somalia, much of the post 9/11 regime. So I'm not going to sit here and pretend I have an answer, but this is the conversation I want to have. When is it legitimate to use force? And when is it not? You know, I'd like to see us raise this conversation from the politics of the moment to have that conversation. When is it okay for? I mean, look, you know, if you want to talk about Greenland and whatnot, totally different. I'm not sure this administration is serious about that. But the conversation I'm not hearing that I'd like to have is when can we use force? When is it not just in our national interest, but in our moral interest to use military force?
You know, I just want to latch on to what you just said about Greenland, because it does seem to me that Greenland, Colombia, Panama, Cuba, these do seem to be things that are thrown out almost to be diversions what happened in
Venezuela?
In Venezuela.
Oh, no, he's been talking about Greenland long before that.
Absolutely, of course. But it is also went dormant for a long time and is now being brought back into the conversation of saying, see, we could do this, and that.
Well, I made an offhanded remark at the top, and maybe I should strike a more earnest note about it when I said the Cold War is back in power politics. That's what this feels like. In other words, I'm in my 60s. I'm used to that that Cold War world, you know, where it was, you know, power politics, so to speak. So you could look at Venezuela, and I'm not saying that this is the way this administration is looking at it, and saying, hey, look, you know, Russia and China, you have no business in this hemisphere, and we're not going to stand for it, okay? That feels very Cold War-ish to me. I suppose you could put Greenland in that as well. I personally don't. Again, I'll believe it when I see it. I don't think it's serious, but it would fit that model.
But the reasons, and I want to get to Teresa, but the reasons for perhaps of going into Greenland, despite what Stephen Miller says, would be very different than the reasons of going into Venezuela. And I don't think you can really. Well, natural resources,
exactly.
Right?
Yes.
Okay.
And to control the Arctic. Because now with global warming, it's opened up.
I'm
diverting you from...
No. And what I meant by that is in the stated goals from the administration.
Right.
Yes. Teresa.
So I think it's, I agree, I want to say from the outset, not an expert in terms of the geopolitical issues, particularly among the countries, you know, around Venezuela and such. But I do think it's important to reflect on the fact that this, not unlike January 6th, which we're going to get to, this issue with Venezuela was built on a series of lies by Trump and the Trump administration. One of the lies that he repeated over and over and over again was that Venezuela emptied out their prisons and their jails, and he called them insane asylums, and then periodically he would call them mental health places, and sent all of those criminals to the U.S. to terrorize us. That's in, with no proof. Constantly they're asked for proof, but it gets repeated over and over again. And then he talked about how the Venezuelan gangs were terrorizing the United States, and he particularly, as we'll recall, focused on a city in Colorado, and there was quite a lot of attention there, and the facts belied the rhetoric, and it was quite a, you know, difficult scene for the people. Even the mayor said to him, please stop, yet he didn't. And then a similar lie was about the drug boats and blowing up drug boats. That was a much more consequential in the sense that there's probably some international laws that were violated there, but repeatedly talking about them sending drugs to the United States. Putting aside for the fact that, in fact, that if you look at his budget, if he was really concerned about drugs in the United States, then why did he cut a significant amount of funding for drug interdiction? Why did Trump administration cut significant funds for drug treatment? But basically built on a series of lies. And then I think we can all agree that Maduro was not a good guy, right? I think there's common agreement that he's a... I haven't heard anyone come to his defense, nor based on what I know, should they. But also think about one of the things that they say about Maduro is that, you know, he wasn't legitimately elected. And you know, what did Trump do when he didn't win the election? He tried to say he did. Now, Maduro was successful in retaining power. Trump was not. But Trump obviously know, he pursued retaining power even though he had not won the vote. So there's some interesting similarities there. But I think the most important thing that I want to focus on is, first of all, note that it was a very amazing military feat that was pulled off. And it's important to note that it was pulled off because, by all accounts from General Kane, there was meticulous planning and really thinking through what would happen in those moments, right? And it was a rather amazing feat. But then you get to the Colin Powell Doctrine, which is the fundamental of question to ask when there's a proposal to do something like this. Is after the initial military action, and then what?
And then
what?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that I really want to focus on the and then what, because it appears like so many other things that the Trump administration doesn't do, they did not think through, work through, plan through the and then what part of this. That there didn't seem to be in their responses in the immediate aftermath that, you know, we're still working through, is really like, who is controlling it? Who's going to be in charge? U.S. boots on the ground or not boots on the ground? And so there is both a price and a cost of and then what? You know, the financial price of, as one of the experts said, I heard say yesterday, listen, this administration can't even run the Kennedy Center, you know, effectively. And there's a lot of questions about how effectively they're running the U.S. How are they going to run this other country, and let alone without putting boots on the ground? And what is the financial cost of doing that when a country with 90% of poverty, right? But then what is the global cost of all of this?
And isn't that what we heard from the UN yesterday?
Correct.
The concern about the global cost.
And the one thing I did do is listen as background to the UN. First of all, noting chaired by the official from Somalia, who is for the month of January the leader. And I thought, given all the things that Trump says about Somalia, I thought that this person leading that discussion, that was interesting. But yes, you heard it from a wide range of perspectives. Now, many of the Venezuelan people who are allowed to speak, now there's a crackdown, there is joy in that he's gone, but trepidation about what's next, how it's all going to work. And one of the things that, and Terry, I really appreciate you talking about the use of language, because the word we didn't hear from Trump, I don't know if I ever heard it, and I didn't listen to everything, but there wasn't the discussion about democracy, that what we're going to try to do there is, there wasn't a talk about how we're going to help the people, and are we trying to establish or reestablish democracy?
Well, that was certainly brought up both during his address to the nation on Saturday morning, as well as the gaggle that he had on Sunday night, that at no time the word democracy was ever used.
Right. That's why I say I didn't hear everything. And I think that that's quite telling. And so clearly in his mind, it's about the oil. And then apparently, speaking about based on lies, he said repeatedly that he talked to the oil executives before and after, which was curious because he hadn't talked to the members of, you know, the Gang of Eight before or after. But then there was a Reuters story that says they, you know, he did talk to them. But he continues to say that he did. And then there's the issue of, there's a whole series of details about, well, if he's after the oil, projections are about $7 billion to get those, the oil drilling operations up and running. But the oil markets are glutted right now. And so the oil executives, like, why, the people who know this area that I've tried to read about in the last 24 hours, say, you know, that's not really what we need right now. And that's not, and it's also a long, long term to get the oil up and going. It's a long, long term. And now Trump is saying, well, the U.S. will pay. It doesn't matter that the oil companies don't want to. The U.S. will pay to get those oil operations running again. How's that going to work? That's billions of dollars. You can't pay for health care. You can't. Anyway.
No, I was just going to, I want to get to Robert too, but I, and Terry, but I one of the things that we touched on this yesterday, that I found it, the thing the president kept on saying is that the question that kept coming up is, what about the problems at home? What about the problems in this country? What about those without health care? What about the economy and so forth? And the answer was that the oil companies, of how well they were going to do and how much money was going to be coming into the country as a result of this action. And I don't know if that case has properly been made, much less has actually been proven.
Can I say one other thing? Because, sure. Because Robert, I just would like to hear you on this. The other thing, and you mentioned, is that China is very actively in Venezuela.
Right.
And Venezuela owes China a tremendous amount of money. They have loaned Venezuela enormous amounts of money, including and specifically to address their resources extraction. And so what is the plan? And Trump wants China out of there. And so what is the plan? How is that going to work? And also Russia is certainly there. So I'd be interested, Robert, would you, like, and so if you're trying to clear, you know, one of the theories is you clear the lanes that, okay, you, and this is what Miller says. The U.S. has, you know, our area, and then China gets the South China Sea and do what they want in Taiwan, and then Russia gets to take over Ukraine and that whole area. So I think that's, you know, fantasy, But you really think that Russia and China are going to leave voluntarily Venezuela? And is the U.S. going to pay off those loans? I mean, how's that going to work?
Yeah, we'll see. You're kind of anticipating a point I wanted to make, Teresa, which is, you know, what do we mean when we say oil? You know, I think there's this impression at loose in the land that, oh, this is just about, you know, grabbing resources and enriching ourselves. Well, it's also about keeping those resources out of the hands and the economies of Russia, of China.
That's not what Trump said. He said he'd sell it to China and sell it to Russia. And then he said, well, we can't sell it to Russia right now, but eventually.
I've long stopped listening to what this president says and not dividing by six. You know, your mileage may vary. That's
no, but I'm saying that's what it was.
This
bonkers.
Gets back into Terry's language point.
But
yes.
Be that as it may, I mean, in other words, the it's sort of facile to say, oh, it's about the oil. Well, yes, it is. But it's about what the oil portends, you know, in terms of keeping, you know, funds out of our enemies, both real and strategic. But I want to go back to something that you said earlier. And look, I thank you for saying it. You know, in this era where we think that especially those of us on the right like to say that government can't do anything well, we sure as hell did a nice job on the planning of that military operation, right? I mean, that was an extraordinary operation. But I completely agree with you. In terms of the meticulous planning that went into that portends well. Let's hope that we put as much strategic thought into after the fact as we did into that. But if I can complete the point, the one, I'm not going to call it an unknown, but the one counterfactual here is this idea that there's going to be, remember the Powell Doctrine, if you break it, you buy it. Well, you know, this kind of thinking has driven, as I understand it, you know, diplomatic thought and military planning for decades now. But that said, look at the example of Iran. For years, we were told we can't possibly do anything about Iran's nuclear program. It will result in a, you know, boots on the ground, a forever war, 100,000 dead Americans. Well, what happened? It was a 39-hour military operation. The guys who did it basically came home the next day and took their kids for soccer. And now 6 months later, that regime is on the verge of toppling. So let's exercise a little bit of humility. I'm not defending what's happened here. I want to be clear. But let's not pretend that we know because this happened, therefore there will inevitably be these after effects. They may not happen.
But that's on, yes, they are on the verge of toppling. Is that good or bad in terms of global dynamics?
It's excellent.
However,
it's unambiguously,
because what's
excellent.
Next? What happens next? And their nuclear program is not decimated as Trump said it was. It wasn't ameliorated as Trump said it was. And
I don't think we know that, Teresa, with
respect. I'm not the expert. I know two people who are. And what I hear when I talk to them is that it's not. And so I'm not the expert. I spent a couple of years on the global spread of nuclear weapons, never became the expert, but I met a bunch of people who were. And
it's pretty close.
Yeah, no.
Pretty good periphery.
I think, set up
Teresa.
The events, and they are all this way. You know, I brought people together. It was bringing people together of different views into the same room to see if they could find some areas of consensus and try to how the world would become safer. And in fact, Condoleezza Rice was among them, and way in the way back, but she wouldn't know me. In any case, I just.
Well, we have to take a break. Terry, is there anything you want to jump in here real quick before we go to a break?
Well, I do think that the Trump administration is extremely serious about Greenland and Cuba and any other country they think that they can put leverage on or even take over. I guess when we come back, I'd like to talk more about that.
Okay, sounds good.
And I have a question for Terry later.
All right. Excellent. All of that and much more coming up after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the Roundtable and to our panel discussion. This morning we have a good one going. Terry Gibson, Teresa Bourgeois, and Robert Pendicio, and we welcome you. Panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. We do have letters. We'll get to those in just a moment. When, Terry, you were talking about, and I'd like you to rephrase the question, but as far as how this fits into a larger plan of, Cuba and Greenland and other places where this administration is looking and how you believe that this is very serious and part of a larger plan, could you articulate that a bit?
Well, I'm not sure it's part of a larger plan because I don't really trust that this administration is really good at planning anything. But I do think that if you look at the history of the way Donald Trump has operated, both as a business person and as a former president, and he's not a policymaker. He's a person that likes to take action. He needs to find a way to feed his ego, and he always looks for the route of least resistance. And what he has discovered with this Venezuelan attack is that he has this power to take the world's largest military and essentially do with it whatever he wants without any resistance, because Congress isn't resisting. And right now, public opinion has not shifted enough that it's resisting. And therefore, he can accomplish things that he feels are important to him, that feed his ego, that make him feel powerful. And I think that Greenland and Cuba and other countries sort of fulfill that need for him and give him something to do. He's clearly not interested in putting his energy into anything related to improving life here domestically. He's just not interested in that, and he's not directing his administrative officials to really deal with those things in any significant manner. Everyone is jumping to sort of please Donald Trump in terms of what he wants now. What he wants now is he wants to be a king. He wants to be a pirate. He wants to take over whatever he can take over and get credit for what he can get credit for. And I just feel like that he is very serious about his aggressive tactics towards Greenland, certainly. And I think Cuba is a very close second. And I think that it's just so important that we not take our eye off of this and that we do everything we can to put pressure on Congress, on our congressional representation, to really push back and stand up and say, no, this is not what we want our country to be. We don't want to become an aggressive country. We don't want to become the bullying country. We talked about NATO a little bit earlier. I wonder if NATO is even really still actually alive. Will Donald Trump really fulfill the mission of NATO if it comes time for us to defend another country? He shows no regard for laws, policy, history, institutions. I can easily see him saying, nope, I think, you know, we'll just let them go and we're not going to help defend them, whoever that might be. So I think these are very scary, serious times, and we really need the other parts of our government to step up and do what they were designed to do. Until it happens, we're going to have a rogue president that's going to continue to use our military in rogue ways.
But isn't this a vision of a – and I think it's as much Stephen Miller's vision as it is Donald Trump's. But isn't this a vision of a different era, a time where there was, you know, each different hemisphere? And aren't we more globally intertwined – And I think it's obviously a very, it's so much of what Trump, the brand is it's a power based on fear as opposed to coalition building. You know, Biden was exactly the opposite. And you think about how he responded in the lead up to and what was going on in Ukraine and doing it with knitting together and strengthening the NATO coalition. And this is really all about trying to, you know, make people fear you and just use your might. And that's really what, if people haven't heard it, I strongly recommend that you listen to the Jake Tapper interview with Stephen Miller yesterday. But it's really based on fear and dominance within the hemisphere. But we aren't restricted to hemispheres anymore. I mean, I know you were on it.
No, I was looking for a piece written by one of my AEI colleagues on the War Powers Act to invoke what he said, and I can't find it on my phone, unfortunately. Which is why, I mean, and I guess I'll phrase this as a question, really, for both Terry and for you, Teresa. A bit of a devil's advocate question, honestly, because I don't want to signal that I'm in favor of what's happening here. But if you want to say that we should not have done this, why would you say that? In other words, how is this inimical to U.S. interest to have removed Maduro? What's the downside?
See, I guess the question is, there was common agreement that Maduro didn't belong there.
Right.
He was not duly elected. He
right.
needed to go.
Right.
But the question is, what is the right way to pressure him to go? Do you build a global coalition to force him out with a whole series of sanctions that everybody agrees to? But then, you know, I mean, you have China and Russia in there, and so that's not in their interest for him to go because they're controlling him.
Okay.
So what is the right way? But is this the right way?
So it's,
and
it's
is
the...
Is it the right... Also, I think there's a bigger question that I think Terry's been getting to also is... What is the proper use of the military? And is this really the proper... The military folks did their part. They prepared. They studied. And they were ready to go. But the rest of the rest of the Trump administration didn't do their part. And that's not fair to the military.
I don't know if that is or isn't true. I don't think we know that yet.
Well, we do know that because they don't have an answer for what's next.
I mean, okay, so... I agree, and I certainly don't want to take away from the military and what they did and the operation that took place. And I don't want to take away from that in any way, shape, or form. But
they have done it?
But there were hostages. We did not do anything to remove those hostages from that situation. There is a vice president. And there is an opposition leader, and what did we do in talking to them? And as far as was reported this morning, as far as the opposition leader, the Nobel Prize winner, there haven't been conversations there since early fall of last year.
And he disparaged her publicly.
Yes, so there is that and I don't think that is. It is part of the military operation, but I agree with Teresa in that is that fair to the military then to not have all of those wagons circled so that those issues are also taken care of while you are at it, for want of a better term?
It sounds like you're better read on this than I am, Joe, but I don't think that because we have not heard does not mean that we do not, that or because we don't know does not mean that it's not in place.
They did not have a common answer to really fundamental questions. And this is a dumb analogy, but I worked on urban crime issues in the city of Boston, and one of the things is addressing the issue of gangs.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that the law enforcement folks I worked with always talked about is you don't take out the head of the gang, right? Without having a plan, because if you do, then there's chaos, mm-hmm. right? Because that's the leader. So you want to take out the third layer of people around them, then the second layer, and then have the person's power dissipate. Or else if you're going to go in, You have to have a plan for what happens after that. Otherwise, you're going to have chaos. And we have seen, and so that's what I worry about, with the leader gone and there's no, you know, what is the leadership structure there? How do you have the place run day to day when it was barely running before? And if it devolves into chaos, then what happens? And who do you send in? And remember that the Trump administration has hollowed out our government. And so the types of entities, whether they're the State Department folks or CIA folks or national security folks, all the kinds of people that you might have work on this, there's just a lot fewer of them.
Yeah. But the reason, at the outset here that I tried to steer the conversation and nobody took the bait about whether... When we should and should not use the military for these any number of these ends, what I'm hearing you say, Teresa, is that you don't object to, quote, regime change. You object to how it was achieved.
I have to put a pit in all this for just a minute, and then we'll be back. I know Terry wants to get in. I know you want to get in, and we'll do all of that. We have the listeners who want to get in.
And I still have questions for Terry.
Okay. All right. So we'll get to all of that, or at least most of it. First, we'll take a break, and we'll go to news with David Gustina. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. We welcome you, panel at WAMC.org. Public policy and communications expert Teresa Bourgeois is here. Terry Gibson, preceptor in public speaking, strategic communications, and public relations for the Faculty of Arts and Sciences at Harvard University is with us. And Robert Pendicio, senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. We have many letters, and I want to get to those. I also, we want to get to other topics as well. So we will kind of continue the conversation as we go through the letters. I think it's probably the best way to do this. And panelists, if you have anything you want to add, not only to the letters, but to the conversation, please just jump in. Pat writes to us and says, I think Trump is only interested in building his monuments and flexing on the world stage. He actually resents doing anything for average and, God forbid, poor Americans. We go to Barbara. You are so right that Trump has no plan. He doesn't care what happens as long as his actions keep his name in the news. He does not care that they threaten our country with war brought about by his reckless wannabe-the-king actions, nor does he care what happens to all of us when, not if, when war is here in our country, on our soil. War will be here, and he just does not care. All of those with a period.
I think he wants to keep his name in the news, but I also think he wants to keep some things out of the news. Epstein files, no budget resolution, health care cuts, on and on.
Dan writes, Cuba, yes. Greenland and Canada, no. Those are distractions. What I want to say is, yes, the military plans well, and the administration has been very lucky so far. No service members killed, although they came very close this time. But that luck will eventually run out. Another Bay of Pigs, question mark. Then we go to this letter from Marion. Wake up, guys. He's serious about Greenland.
I agree.
Whenever we think he's joking because it's so outlandish, he does it. Malignant narcissists are programmed to expand territory even when it overreaches enough to destroy their own interests. Think Hitler, Russia, Putin, Ukraine. There is one mentally ill person terrorizing America and the world, and it is Donald Trump. I just want to clarify something I said earlier, which I'm not saying that he is not interested in Greenland or Cuba or Colombia. What I am saying is that I think the fact that those get thrown out by the president while we're talking about Venezuela is also a way to further muddy the waters so that it is not just a sole conversation on Venezuela.
Well, I just think it's part of his style of this drumbeat, drumbeat, drumbeat. You know, it saw it at the beginning with Obama and the birth certificate, right? He wasn't born. He just said it incessantly. And this is his pattern. He says things incessantly till you get to the point where they're normalized or people just sort of stop hearing it, but I think that his fixation on Greenland is real. I think Cuba is probably more Rubio than him, but he's fine to go along with it. Remember that the vast majority of the people who were killed reportedly so far were Cubans in the attack in Venezuela. And but I do think that he is serious, and certainly Stephen Miller is deeply serious about taking control of Greenland because of where it sits in the Arctic and because it has an abundance of rare earths, minerals, and yeah.
All right.
I think it's also just important to point out that this is what's important to him, and he clearly shows that every day. The reason he talks about these things is because he's excited about them. You can just see the fire in his eyes when it comes to talking about Greenland and Cuba and accessing other resources and power and taking over the countries. You can just see how it excites him. And so he does talk about it in a sort of crazed, excited way. He just can't help himself. You could never get him up there to really talk about domestic issues in this way because he's not excited about them. It really points to what his focus is and where he's focusing all of America's might, all of America's finances, all of America's military is all focused on these goals that really ultimately have no benefit to the American people, certainly in the short term. And I think we could debate whether they even do in the long term.
But what he knows how to do, I agree with you, Terry, and what he knows how to do is deals. And I think he sees these as deals, but not in the context of any traditional global order or understanding or caring about the repercussions of what his language means. And it's all based on attacks and fear, not coalition building. And this gets back to Robert talking about, well, you know, his question to me is, do you believe in there should have been regime change? I don't think it should have been done in that way because they haven't, they weren't at the, I think it's a misuse of the military because he hadn't prepared for what's next. And I also don't think you do this without building a coalition and having a plan. And you do it, if you're from the United States, in the context of focusing on democracy.
And, well, I think it's also important to point out that there really hasn't been a regime change.
Right.
I mean, the people that are now running Venezuela are the same people that were running Venezuela under Maduro. It's just that Maduro is gone. There's a new leader, but they're all people that are part of that system. The same, if you want to call them narco traffickers, all those people are still in place. It hasn't changed at all. So I don't really feel like it can be qualified as a real regime change at this point in time. I think that is going to have to happen, I guess, either through additional military intervention or a longer process of what would eventually be a fair election. And I'm not sure which of those is going to happen. And I'm worried about the economic aspect of it in the meantime. And I'm especially alarmed by everything that we read from this administration being constantly focused on how the oil is going to be managed in Venezuela. This seems to be the only thing they care about, really. It just comes up in every single conversation. And the idea that's somehow going to benefit Americans financially is, to me, seems ludicrous based on everything you're hearing from both oil executives and just the history and the status of how the oil is currently being used. It's very disturbing.
And that's what I was going to ask you, Robert. Sorry.
No, go ahead.
Robert, do you think Trump cares who's in control there as long as he controls the oil?
I can't say anything other than what I said in the prior segment, which was, you have to be clear on what you mean when you say oil. It is not just about our own economic enrichment. It is about denying that resource to our literal enemies, Iran, and our strategic enemies, China and Russia.
But he's already said that he's going to sell the oil to China and then eventually Russia.
Okay, that's fine.
Is it fine?
Are we in favor of trade or not? I mean, would you rather trade with our enemies and have some economic control over them or not? I mean, these are strategic policy questions.
Let's go to Deborah, who writes, it's about unfettered power. Per Maddow and others yesterday, it's a test of private control of the world's largest, most distributed armed forces. Trump's ego knows no bounds. Why would he stop dominating the Western Hemisphere? Why not king of the world? Then we go to Linda, who says Trump says he doesn't. He didn't notify Congress because he was afraid of leaks. I learned this morning that he did not, that he did notify several billionaire oil executives. Teresa made that point earlier.
How do we know that?
So that they could, I believe he said that, right?
Did he?
He said that, but Reuters reports that they actually talked to some the key oil companies, and they say that he didn't, so I don't know what's true. But he has repeatedly said he talked to them before and after. When reporters asked him, he specifically had said, and several times he has said, yes, I spoke with him before and after.
Then we go to...
I just want to just commend just the past letter writer that mentioned King of the World. I do think it's, at least from my perspective, I think there's
James
a lot
Cameron
of...
moment for us
just,
all.
Just what I was thinking.
Yes, go ahead.
You know, I believe that Donald Trump is not trying to become King of the World. I think in his mind, he is King of the World. I believe that he sees himself right now as the legitimate King of the World, and is going to continue to act in a way that reflects that. And I don't think he's trying to become it. I think he fully believes that he has the power to be that now.
I love my fellow panelists and our letter writers, but man, I envy your certainty about, I wish I was as certain about anything as some folks seem to be about everything.
Well, I will phrase that a little bit different. My view is I worry that he feels he can do what he wants, and I mostly worry he feels he can use the military in any way that he wants, both around the world and in the United States. And I spent 2 years working in the House Judiciary Committee, and one of the things that we spent a lot of time, and this was back in the 80s, is posse comitatus, and the proper use of the military in the U.S., which is, you know, not, except for rescue, not for military purposes. And then we're going a little astray here. But I am deeply worried about what I see as a very strategic effort on his part to do two things. One is to get the American public used to him using the military and the streets of American cities. And the second is weaponizing the military against his political foes, in, you know, strategically both creating this ICE, separate ICE force with the $43 billion that Congress gave him, and then in the National Guard and other things, to strategically target, you know, Democrats in Minneapolis, the Democratic governor of Illinois, all these people who may, you know, who have their sights on higher office. I think that's worrisome.
Having failed to spark a conversation about when it is and is not okay to use the military overseas, please let me know, Joe, when we have the conversation on the roundtable about the expansion of presidential powers over the last several decades, because I want in on that conversation.
Well, I'm just wondering
how
if
does
it really
Thursday
matters.
Look for
I'm busy Thursday, so Robert definitely wants to do it. I'm not here.
Go ahead, Terry. I'm sorry.
I mean, I'm happy to have a debate and discussion about the topic, but I'm just wondering if it really matters, because what I see is plenty of evidence to indicate that Donald Trump doesn't care. I think Teresa is right. I think he sees himself as having complete authority. He said over and over, even yesterday, he said, no, we do not need Congress's approval to do what we did.
He's right.
I think
he doesn't.
I no,
think
that's,
that he
he's not
is already,
right.
Sorry. He's going to, he is going to use the military however he sees fit. It doesn't relate to policy or laws or beliefs or history. So I'm not sure it really matters what we think and how we examine that. What matters is what Congress thinks. Does Congress think that there are actually laws worth upholding? Does Congress think that their power is actually worth using? Does Congress think that they should actually be a check on the president? And the answer to all those questions so far is basically been no. And until they decide to step up and use the power that the Constitution gave them to do that, then I think this whole debate about what we think about policy is, I'm not sure it's worth it.
Terry, I agree with you. I've made this point repeatedly on the roundtable about Congress's AWOL status in recent decades. But again, I've got to be a fact checker here. The War Powers Act of 1973, by my read, absolutely gives the president authority to use the military in this way as long as he informs Congress within 48 hours.
United States. He doesn't have the authority to use the military in the United States.
Teresa, I'm sorry, but I'm pretty sure he does.
He does not.
All right, we'll add that to Thursday's conversation. We'll
which
put
I
that
won't
on.
Be at. But you know, I mean, he doesn't have the power to freeze funding. I mean, the courts, he's lost in the courts over and over again. He doesn't have the power to fire people in the way that he does. He doesn't have the power to freeze funding that the Congress appropriated in the way he does. The problem is, where is our, you know, Howard Baker? Where is our John Dean? I mean, the second half of John Dean, not the first half. Not the half.
John.
And, you know, where, at what point, and this gets back to the 5th anniversary of the January 6th, you know, I thought for sure, after January 6th, the Congress would say, enough, this is totally beyond bounds. And yet they didn't. And what has Trump done the last 5 years? He's tried to rewrite what happened that day. And as two of the police officers speak publicly, it's right there on videotape. I mean, people can watch the tape, and yet he's still in some ways succeeding in rewriting the history of what happened on that, trying to rewrite the history. Sorry, more letters. Sorry, Jeff.
All right. We'll go back to letters, and we go to Andrew, we have just given China permission to take Taiwan and Russia to take Ukraine. I will bet China moves against Taiwan before Trump leaves office. Then Jay says,
"Yeah, well, I do think I'm sorry, I have to respond on that because
please.
I think that can't be that is a big part of this, and that these actions, which are very aggressive actions, that have not really been fully justified to the level that I believe the American people deserve, or that the world deserves to that matter. And so many questions are left unanswered. I do think that it really gives approval to other bully nations that want to use their might to go in and take over other countries and other resources. It makes it very hard for us to make an argument that somehow is inappropriate when we're doing basically the same thing and talking about doing it more. In other countries,
and, yeah.
You know, it's one thing to go in and remove a leader. It's a whole other thing to go in and take over, you know, Greenland or Cuba. I mean, right now we are really responsible for what happens in Venezuela. And we have a significant portion of our military sitting right outside that country waiting to do God knows what. So how we can sort of point to China now or point to Russia now and saying what you're doing is bad, at least how the administration could do that, to me seems kind of difficult.
And again, it raises a question, what is the price and what is the cost of that? And I think there are a lot of questions that need to be answered about what, and maybe they're unanswerable, but what is the reordering going to be now? And what are the implications for trade policy, for instance? You know, what's going to happen with trade with Mexico? What's going to happen with trade with Colombia? All those people love coffee. Are you going to have a harder time getting coffee? But seriously, I mean, what is going to happen with our farmers who were trading with a lot of these countries in South America? And are they going to be less likely? And they going to look elsewhere? And they think that, well, China and Russia will leave. Well, I think China and Russia will stay, and perhaps they will get a stronger foothold in some of these countries who feel that they need some protection against the U.S. You know, the opposite of what they claim might happen. I think there's a lot of dynamics. And then what is this going to do to NATO?
All right. Let me get through as many letters as we can here in the next 5 minutes, because after the break, I want to get to January 6th of the anniversary. So we go as quick as we can. If anybody wants to jump in, please do. Ed says, Bush had Hussein, Obama had bin Laden, now Trump has his bad guy. It's about legacy building for him. Jill says, it won't surprise me one bit very soon if Trump says to Venezuelans living in the U.S., okay, it's safe for you all to go back home now, and start supporting Venezuelans. Granted, many may want to go back, but those that don't or who have legal status to stay here, he'll have ICE rounding them up and sending them to detention centers. Don writes, the administration is saying this was not an act of war, but just law enforcement. What would the fallout be in the U.S. if 80 reported bystanders were killed to capture two criminals? Then we go to Terry. It's about the Epstein files. Everything is a distraction. Carnage does not matter. Then David says, I'm convinced that Venezuelan oil is actually a red herring. I put my money on Venezuelan gold and Venezuelan coastline. That is where the real money is, and it won't take a lot of time or investment. Similar to the Gaza coastline, that's where billions can be made. Then John checks in. This is a long one. We asked for these to be short, but John, I've clicked on your letter, so we're knee-deep here. The current Supreme Court wants to talk original intent. Okay, let's talk original intent. When the founders wrote the Constitution, the only form of military action outside a country was a declaration of war. Congress declares war under Article 1. Congress under Article 1 is what creates the military, not just funds it. Congress under Article 1 can disband the military. There was no standing in the U.S. in 1800. While at war, the president is commander-in-chief. Wars end. The treaties are created jointly by the president and the Senate.
Jefferson sent the nascent U.S. Navy after the Barbary Pirates.
Back to pirates. Bravo to Mr. Gibson, says Paul. We now have a president threatening to murder a head of state in another country. We have a regime threatening multiple countries with organized crime style tactics. We murder people on boats without any judicial process. We murder shipwrecked survivors contrary to the code of military justice. We also brutalize immigrants and our own citizens with thug-style tactics. We have an FCC trying to extort the media companies. But of all the countries being threatened, Russia is treated with high respect and deference, like a mob boss who knows the mob boss has something on him. Less than a minute, we go to Vincent. What if Trump has concluded that Gonzalez is a thug that he can control and work with and keep in power without the pesky Democratic opposition getting in the way? As the saying goes, she's a dictator, but she's our dictator. That, of course, meaning the vice president of Venezuela, currently serving as president. And then Dan writes, I'm looking at what is going on versus what is supposed to be happening this week, and all I can think is that the Epstein files must be much worse than I expected. We'll take a break. When we come back, we'll talk about the anniversary of January 6th, 5 years ago that occurred. We'll talk about that and much more. We welcome your letters, and we'll be back right after this short break. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. Teresa Bourgeois, Terry Gibson, and Robert Pendicio with us this morning, and we thank you very much for being with us. It makes the day much better. And we thank you for your letters. Got to as many as I possibly could. So let's talk about January 6th. That is the other issue that I wanted to get to. And this morning's program today marks the fifth anniversary of January 6th and what happened with the rioting at the Capitol following the 2020 election. So two things that I would like to mention and then turn it over to our esteemed panel. While this week marks the fifth anniversary of the attack on the U.S. Capitol, an NPR investigation details how the Trump administration is trying to erase government information on the attack. Since President Trump returned to office, his administration has actively tried to erase government information about the January 6, 2021 attack by his supporters on the U.S. Capitol. NPR is preserving the history of that day, and they've created a public archive featuring hundreds of videos submitted as evidence, a timeline of events, and a searchable database of those cases, plus a two-part podcast on that day and the aftermath. But there's a lot there that is not being mentioned now, certainly by this administration. And we'll remember that it was a day of love, is the president's last words on that. Maybe not his last words, but certainly the wrap up, if you will. Then the other thing is when we look at what has, and I thought this was a really interesting story too, which is the New York Times look at the for those rioters in January 6th, they were pardoned from Trump. But this article in the New York Times goes into great detail about how that pardon really wasn't enough. Some pardon rioters have been rearrested, others returned to poverty and mental health challenges, and many became consumed by resentment and demands for payback. The pardon proclamation saved them, opening prison doors and ending all of the criminal prosecutions related to the Capitol attack. Even more, it gave a presidential stamp of approval to their inverted vision of January 6th, 2021, that those who assaulted the police and vandalized the historic building that day were victims, and those who spent the next 4 years using the criminal justice system to hold them accountable were villains. But nearly a year after Mr. Trump's sweeping proclamation asserted that he had cleared the way for a process of national reconciliation, a quote, many recipients of his clemency remain consumed by conspiracy theories, angry at the Trump administration for not validating their insistence that the Capitol attack was a deep state setup, and haunted by problems from both before and after the riot. Teresa.
The Trump and his administration, key people in his administration, are working very hard as he, you know, Trump worked very hard to redefine what happened in the election and has been using all the tools of government to try to redefine what happened 5 years ago today in the insurrection. And he lost the election, and if you listen to Jack Smith's testimony, which became public on New Year's Eve, he was at the heart of the cause of the insurrection, the violent insurrection at the Capitol. And as the police officers say, even though it's on tape, because of his repeated efforts and because of using a lot of the mechanisms of the administration, he is in some ways succeeding in trying to change the thought about what happened that day. But the facts remain the facts. And the problem is, in the process of doing that, not only is he trying to distort history, but he's doing it in two ways. One thing, pardoning those insurrectionists, including the most violent, who were charged after due process. But also, they have dismissed or driven out enormous numbers of people in the Justice Department who were involved in those prosecutions, just doing their job. And by accounts of some who have looked at this, they've lost our country has lost enormous talent, enormous prosecutorial capacity, because those people have been driven out. So just to deal with, you know, and in the end, it also those who've suffered probably the most are those 140-some police officers who were so deeply injured that day. And their injuries, both physical and mental, stick with them, and they have not gotten the support. And this crew is so petty that there's something that I think is symbolic, not the most important thing, but a symbolic thing, is that there's a plaque. Congress approved that a plaque would be put up in memory and honor of right. those who served, the Capitol Police plus the Metropolitan Police. And it was supposed to be up by 2023. And they are still blocking it exists, but they, Johnson, because Trump doesn't want it up, because it would affirm what happened, they won't even put up a plaque to honor these folks, let alone give them the supports that they need. It was an assault on our democracy. It happened.
Well, we have those really cool plaques in the Hall of Presidents that are going down in the White House, right? Those are cool.
I think we should all use our voices to get them to put up the plaque. Yeah. Sorry, Robert.
Robert.
No. Look, it was a dark day. Period, full stop. It was a stain on our nation's history. Look, Joe, the only comment I can make is one, frankly, I've made on the roundtable before. As somebody who works in education and concerns myself with young people, I continue, and I hope I'm wrong about this, okay, what I'm about to say, but I continue to be deeply troubled by our relationship to political violence in this country. Every political tribe in America now has a story it tells itself about why violence from its own side doesn't really count. The excuses are familiar and depressing. Oh, it was just a protest that got out of hand. They were pushed to it. The system left them no choice. It was symbolic. It wasn't real violence. What troubles me the most, from my perspective, is polling that shows that a growing number of Americans, particularly young Americans, believe that political violence is sometimes justified. That suggests to me something I desperately do not want to be true, that we're raising a generation that increasingly views politics not as persuasion, but as something akin to moral warfare. So, yeah, January 6th was wrong. Antifa street violence is wrong. The George Floyd riots were wrong. Shooting a healthcare CEO in the back is wrong. Political violence is wrong, period, full stop, end of discussion.
Okay. I want to ask about George Floyd, but I don't
equate those.
There you go. There you go.
But why? I mean, you can protest it. I just want clarification. I'm sorry. So, real quick. But why is that? How is that the same?
I didn't say it was the same. I said these were all acts of political of political expression involving violence. Property destruction.
Okay.
That's
all right.
Violence.
All right. Terry.
Well, I think one of the things that strikes me is it's an interesting – you could have an interesting discussion about whose responsibility it is to preserve American history. We see that throughout the history of our country, different administrations have gone to different lengths to revise history, to change history. This administration has gone to extraordinary lengths to really erase history, and not just recent history, but going all the way back to history at the beginning of our country. And we're fortunate that we have so many historians, that we have so many institutions that have really devoted their lives and their time and their resources to preserving the history of this country, because we certainly can't count on government to do it. The January 6th, to me, was one of the darkest days in the country in my lifetime here. It continues to haunt me. It continues to disturb me. And much like Robert, I am disturbed by how much of the American public, at least as polling shows, as survey shows, seems to not be that bothered by what happened. And enough seem to not be bothered that this anniversary will kind of slip by without a lot of ceremonies, without a lot of recognition. And it feels as if we are becoming a more violent country by the day, that we're becoming more accepting of violence by the day, both domestically and abroad. And if that's the direction our democracy is heading, then we will no longer be able to sort of be the leader in the world to kind of set a moral standard. I think that our ability to do that is quickly fading, and Donald Trump administration are really expediting that. So January 6th, I think, was not just a single moment. I think it was really the beginning of a movement in this country that has continued to evolve and allow others to sort of express themselves in sometimes violent ways. And to me, it's incredibly sad that we have never been able to really give those who defended the Capitol that day and who lost their lives and were injured, to really give them the credit they deserve and the recognition they deserve. And the idea that those individuals who attacked our Capitol, our congressional hearings, were then pardoned, me is just decimating. It's just almost hard to bear that was allowed to happen.
I know you want to respond, Teresa. I want to take a quick break, and we'll come back, finish up the show. And we welcome your letters as well. Panel@WAMC.org. Panel@WAMC.org. We'll be back right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. We're wrapping up on this Tuesday morning, the 6th of January, and talking about the fifth anniversary of the attack on the Capitol on January 6th, 2021. Teresa, I know you wanted to say a bit more on this.
Right. And I just can't get over what happened on January 6th. And I agree with you, Terry, that, you know, it needs to be marked. But what I wonder and worry about is, how do we preserve our democracy if we cannot tell the truth about one of the fundamental, really, you know, attacks on that democracy? And if the people who the insurrectionists involved were not ultimately, they were held accountable, but then they were pardoned. and then, as Jack Smith said, fundamentally, that Donald Trump was the key. It would not have happened without him. I don't have the exact quote in front of me, but he made a very clear, repeated, powerful statement in his testimony that it was fundamentally, he was, Donald Trump was responsible, yet not held accountable by others. And that's really not on him. That's on the Republicans, who made excuses and who are now trying to alter how we perceive it. And so really my question, and Robert, somewhat to you too, but my question that I've been wanting to ask Terry, both about what's going on in Venezuela, but also more importantly, how January 6th is discussed, is how does this generation really understand democracy when it's being, the Trump administration is really trying to redefine it by not following the basic guidelines or constraints or parameters of what I grew up to know democracy to be, you know, three different branches of government, each having their roles and responsibilities, that you collaborate as opposed to, you know, Trump operates from a position of conflict, you know, that he's going to win and not, as opposed to he's going to bring people together and reach some consensus among disparate views. And so I worry that for the last decade, these young people growing up have, you know, I guess I keep thinking, as Hillary Clinton's ad said, the children are watching. And, you know, what have they learned about how our democracy actually is supposed to work?
I'll defer to Terry, but I also would like to be here, Joe, the day we discuss reforming presidential pardon authority.
Well, I mean, you look
at... You know, you're going to put all the proper paperwork, fill out the forms, and please submit that to the office, and we'll get these on the docket.
Well, or two, besides the pardons of the January 6th, remember Trump not only pardoned the Honduran leader, but also the guy who was involved in, what was it called, Silk Road, the website that was for drug trafficking, extensive drug trafficking.
All I want to say, I was against presidential pardons before it was cool.
But again, he's not, as with everything, not following the process. But I really want to hear from Terry about where young people are today in terms of having not, you know, having gone through this last 10 years where a different type of quote-unquote democracy has been modeled by Trump and his administration.
Terry Gibson.
Well, I don't want to be the spokesperson for all young people, but...
You're the one that's around them.
I do
your observations.
I spend a lot of time in classrooms with them, and that's certainly true. My perception is that young people today are really no different than young people since the history of time. You know, my generation as a young person was exposed to the Vietnam War and Watergate and everything that came after that. And that certainly formed sort of my opinion and my generation's opinion about what democracy looks like and how it works. This generation that is now in undergraduate colleges across the country, they grew up being exposed to a completely different set of examples. And Donald Trump played and continues to play a big part in that. And so their view of how the world works and how democracy works, I think it's quite different. I'm not going to say that one is better than the other, I think that, they're just influenced by different examples. And I think that they may very well be in some situations more conditioned to accepting violence, accepting behavior that would normally be unacceptable to older generations like myself, because the examples they see are acting that way and they're getting away with it.
Right. But it seems
they don't see that Donald Trump is being held accountable. They don't see that people that break the law are being held accountable. Therefore, maybe it's just part of what democracy is about. So they don't have a lot of great examples in the current time to really work with. And I think that's why history and teaching history accurately is so important to every generation, so that we can always have a fuller view of what democracy is and where it came from and how it works and when it's failed and when it's succeeded. Without sort of looking at the entire existence of the country, it's hard for any generation, I think, to really have a full picture of what democracy means.
Terry, if I can, I think it's exactly the opposite. I'm 63 years old. I made this point during the year-end roundtable. I grew up in an era where political violence was absolutely normal. 1,200 domestic bombings in 1971 and 1972, airline hijackings, assassinations, etc. I remember being surprised that was not the norm. And I think young people today are growing up, have grown up in a relatively peaceful time. We're used to saying, you know, oh, things have never been worse. Frankly, they've never been better if viewed through this lens. So the frustration, if I might, is probably a frustration with democracy. If I can't get what I want through standard means, that justifies the use of violence, perhaps.
I'm going to take what you just said and just alter it slightly. To me, it seems like, because, yes, I grew up, I'm 58. So I'm growing up in, as I become aware, late 60s, early 70s, mm-hmm. and Vietnam, Watergate, how that's affecting my older brothers and the family, and we're seeing what's going on, then going into, of course, Carter and Reagan, and my brother going into military action within the time of the Reagan administration. I guess those aren't great examples, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, those aren't great examples, and they're violent examples. But I was always, because of the education and because of, and I'll say it, I think because I lived in Philadelphia, we learned a lot about the nation. And I think I worry, and I don't know if you agree with this or not, Terry, but I think we don't give students and kids enough credit for knowing right and wrong and understanding so do we understand political violence? I would say if they understand the Trump administration, if they understand that fully, then they will have a better understanding of what is right and what is wrong.
From your lips to God's ears.
Well, I mean, I just worry about the modeling of a president who says just blatantly racist things, and most recently about the Somali Americans.
But there's always going to be a devil.
But
meaning you're modeling, but you're modeling a negative example, right? So if you're looking at that from a student or a young perspective, don't you think you can see the white hat or the black hat?
I just hope that this behavior doesn't become normalized. I fear it becomes normalized. I think that he is who he is, but the other parts of the system, I say this all the time, aren't working. The Republican check on the system isn't working. The people saying, no, that's not how we behave. That's the part that's not happening. Because you did have Nixon, who had a lot of strengths, but he had a fundamental weakness, right? But ultimately, the check on the system worked. And Republicans came to him and said, enough is enough, right? And you did have the Watergate hearings where Barbara Jordan, you know, I mean, I was a weird kid. I watched them. And I watched the Watergate hearings. We had one TV. It was only schedule watching. We weren't allowed unless we got approval of what to watch. But baseball, we were always approved for that. And I was approved for the Watergate hearings. The Three Stooges, because there were three of us, my two brothers, like the Three Stooges. It had to be, we had to agree on what.
Well, now that's political violence.
I hate it. I hated it because it was violent, and I hate violence. But seriously, I wonder about if you have the president of the United States who pardons insurrectionists and does not support the police who protected our democracy, what does that model to it? Again, I go back to it's Pollyannish, but I think this is the year of the people. It's going to be up to us to preserve our democracy. I worry about the stress on our democracy right now.
We're out of time, so we're going to have to leave it there. But there's a lot, obviously, we can discuss, and I know we'll have further conversations as we go.
Thank you to our police.
Robert has all kinds of ideas on shows we can do, and I appreciate that, and we'll try to bring them to the fore. I thank all of you for being with us. Terry Gibson, congratulations for being here, making it through, and I wish you a happy new year to Teresa and to Robert. Thank you so much. We'll be back right after this short break.